This is Trepwire Week in Review for week ending September 23rd. I'm Martha Kocher with Trep, a data modeling and analytics firm for the CMBS, commercial real estate, and CLO markets. I'm with Manus Clancy, Senior Managing Director, and Joe McBride, Head of CRE Finance. Joining us today is our own Lonnie Hendry, Head of Advisory Services. This week, the Fed shifted its tone, signaling a taper announcement coming soon, and the congressional stalemate on the federal debt limit is in the news cycle. In economic data, initial jobless claims were worse than expected. A measure of U.S. service providers and manufacturers slowed to a one-year low, and housing starts rose last month, driven by a surge in multifamily construction. And investors started the week jittery that the collapse of heavily indebted property developer China Evergrande would send aftershocks in global markets. Manus, markets seemed less concerned about any ripple from Evergrande's demise. What's changed?
Well, I think that there's been some distance between the initial shock that Evergrande has $300 billion in debts trading at, you know, 25 cents on the dollar and is facing a painful restructuring for which it's unclear how it will unravel, right? When that first started to become apparent or really sunk in on Monday, we saw a really, really painful sell-off. Tuesday ended relatively flat. But that kind of was misleading because the market really saw some crazy whipsaws and heightened volatility on Tuesday. By Wednesday, you're now kind of into day three. Nobody is out there saying we have huge exposure to Evergrande, right? It's sitting in this fund or that fund. It's threatening to take down this bank or that bank, right? So distance created some level of relief. And then on top of that, equally supportive of the market was the fact that the Fed came out and basically said, tapering soon, interest rate hikes shortly thereafter, but in the process underscored the fact that the economy, the U.S. economy, is generally chugging along at a decent pace. So between the time element from the initial shock of Evergrande and kind of the confident words of the Fed coming out of the two-day Fed meeting, I think confidence was restored for investors. You know, the one thing that concerns me more than anything this week is that one of these days, after confidence keeps getting restored and restored and restored, right? We have something happen, inflation, people get worried, and then confidence comes back. Evergrande comes, people get nervous, confidence comes back. At some point, people will start completely neglecting these potential risks, drive the market higher. And when a real risk does slap the market, people will be unprepared for it. They'll be unprepared for just how painful something like this can be.
So this Evergrande story, I shouldn't really compare China to the US in terms of their financial system, but it has some corollaries to some of the things that happened leading up to the GFC. The government in general was promoting high levels of debt in order to build more and more apartment buildings and housing, which was boosting GDP numbers and also creating housing for all these hundreds of millions of people that were coming from the rural areas into the cities. And, you know, this company, like many others, rode that boom all the way to today. And in the last year or so, based on everything I've been reading, the Chinese government has realized that they need to cool this thing down. And that another thing is that turning their focus to more high-tech manufacturing and other things where they're saying, we don't want 30% of GDP to be in construction. We don't want 25% of our wealth to be in real estate. We want it to be in these other asset classes or areas. And nothing in China happens that's not because of a government mandate or because of an implied government mandate. So this thing didn't happen without China knowing that it was going to happen, right? And even today, we saw stories about how the Chinese government has been warning city governments and municipalities that they're going to let this thing fail. And so just get ready. Don't let anyone protest and all those other types of things. But they're going to figure something out to make sure that the millions of people who bought apartments that have not been built yet are not totally left out in the cold, I think. And I think that that's I remember in college, I was in college during the Great Financial Crisis. There's all this talk about moral hazard, right? And you're always like, what the hell does moral hazard even mean? Well, basically just means when you know that you can kind of do whatever you want and you won't be, the consequences aren't there for you, kind of. You know, at some point or another, the market is in a moral hazard territory, right? With so much liquidity and so much kind of support from all facets, monetary and fiscal. Why would I ever sell anything? If I see the market go down by 5%, I'm going to borrow on margin and buy more, right? And at some point that will hit us. I just don't know when.
If any of you want to develop a derivative based on Joe, right, the Joe Financial Index, and you want to go short Joe, let us know. We're good at kind of developing complicated financial models. We can go long at short Joe, or even Lonnie for that matter.
We did do the CMBS iBox index. We could do the Joe iBox. I'd be long Joe though. No offense.
Yeah, I'm in the long Joe camp as well. I would piggyback off of what you said, Joe, and some of the reading I did. It seems like the government in China has been promoting this common prosperity theme lately. And I think part of that narrative was that a lot of folks in China had amassed significant wealth through the real estate acquisition. So when they privatized the marketplace, I think it was around 1998, the government subsidized a lot of early financing, and a lot of people that had the means available at that time really capitalized on that. So there were some stories of people owning hundreds of homes, and with some of their childbirth limitations and other things, like people amassing huge amounts of inheritance from both sides of the grandparents. So they were trying, I think, to stymie this a little bit. So if we had been proactive, we probably could have seen some of this coming. Would you're indebted as much as the developer was, and the government's, you know, putting out messages that they want common prosperity. It's just a matter of time before the rubber met the road. And I think we're almost there.
I think the ruling party's new slogan was houses are for living in, not for speculation, which I thought was interesting. Manus, there's obvious comparisons to the Great Financial Crisis and the fact that, you know, property values were behind a lot of this, and in some cases comparing it to Lehman. Is this another Lehman?
Well, it's a little bit hard to tell right now, right? Things were very opaque then, right? Who had exposure to Lehman debt? Who had exposure to Bear Stearns debt before that, right? And it took a while for that to play out. It may take even longer to play out with Evergrande. It remains to be seen. You know, one thing I would point out, we'll compare and contrast, you know, the two things. People that weren't around during the Great Financial Crisis or didn't live in the kind of the day-to-day of what was happening to security values and home price values and commercial property values and bank defaults and so forth, when they hear the word Lehman, there might be this tendency to think Lehman caused the Great Financial Crisis. And that's really not true. Lehman was the output of bad behavior in the financial crisis, right? Lehman was one of many doing things that were reckless. It just turned out that Lehman had levered itself probably more than most and had the smallest margin of error. And that's why they became the biggest blow up of that time frame. But when you go through the list of people that and people, entities, and agencies that were caught up in this, right? It's Lehman. It was Merrill that basically had to be taken out of B of A, Wachovia, which had to be taken out by JP Morgan, Washington Mutual, which went belly up, Fannie and Freddie, which had to be recapitalized and take under conservatorship, the owners of Stuytown, a 20,000 unit, $5 billion market cap, multifamily complex in Manhattan, belly up, 666 Fifth Avenue, a $2 billion office complex in Manhattan, right? Harry Macklow losing the GM building. All of these came from one thing, right? And it was bad lending discipline. Very little skin in the game, incredibly highly leveraged, extraordinary property values, execution risk. All of these things helped bring down the commercial real estate empires of many, and not just commercial real estate, residential, of course, via subprime, right? All of that bad hygiene trickled through the market and hit all of those players that I'm talking about. Beyond that, there were people who lent to Lehman, to Merrill, to Wachovia, to others, right? That once they realized that they were on the hook to basically bad debts to these players that were taking on way too much risk or mispricing risk, you know, or were undercapitalized, right? That's when you started to see the domino effect. To boil this down as a Lehman versus Evergrande would be too simplistic. It's a much bigger issue in 2008. Today, we just don't know, right? What we do know is that Evergrande has $300 billion in debt, right? We know that some of that debt is owned by big financial institutions. We know that some of it is Chinese denominated. Some of it is US dollar denominated. We know that these debts are trading at 25 cents on the dollar. What we don't know is, are any of the players indebted to Evergrande so undercapitalized or so highly levered that this can become a contagion? My guess is no. We've taken a lot of steps as a society to rebuild the capital of banks, to put in better risk management. But until the dust settles, you're never really sure.
Yeah, so I guess I'll just say one more thing. We can move on. I mean, I think the financial markets have mostly moved on already. So maybe we're talking too much about it. But Lehman imploded for all the reasons that you just mentioned, Manus, but they were also allowed to implode by the Fed and by the regulators, as opposed to then the Fed realized, oh man, we can't let this happen to three more of the big giant banks in New York. And they stepped in and forced all those combinations that you mentioned. So, you know, in my mind, being the China, you know, regulatory and government expert that I am, just like my epidemiology background, they're trying to make an example of this company to say, to enforce this new rule of shared prosperity that Lonnie mentioned, but they're not going to let the whole system fall. That whole economy is managed by, you know, the Politburo. So they're not going to let that go down in flames like it would have to for us to really worry that much about it here in the US.
Yeah, I wondered for a while. A couple of weeks ago, they had that story where the Chinese government was going to limit children to 3 hours a week of video time, right? Video gaming time, and none during the week. And it dawned on me this week, what is more likely to trigger peasants with pitchforks? Was it taking away people's gaming ability, or was it forcing people to live under a lean-to? Right? Listen, I don't know.
As much as, you know, the Chinese government is incredibly powerful, just thinking about me trying to get my son to stop watching Curious George to go to bed. Like, can you imagine doing that to, you know, half a billion kids? Like, I don't know. Like, they could enforce a lot of things, but I don't know if they could really enforce that one.
Moving on to a headline story that our own Tripwire team uncovered, and it involves underpayment to several CMBS bondholders, and it's a complicated story a little bit, so it's going to take a little time to walk through.
Thanks, Martha. Hopefully, this will not lose half our audience, and it's incumbent upon Martha, Joe, and Lonnie to make sure that I don't drone on for 20 minutes about this particular story. But it was an interesting one. You could probably call this an educational segment. So one of the things that makes CRE lending and CRE finance so different than residential and corporate and so forth is its lumpiness. And what do we mean by lumpiness? In CRE, you have many-to-many relationships, right? You would have one property, one loan in one CMBS deal. You could have one property supporting many loans in one deal. You could have one property backing many loans in many deals, right? Your debts are carved up into many pieces. You could also have portfolio loans that are carved into many pieces as well. So it makes things very lumpy. And the story we're about to talk about is a function of some of this lumpiness. What can happen when you don't cross all your T's and dot all your I's? So in this particular case, we were talking about the Torrance Technology Campus in California. It backed a $94 million CMBS debt package, and that debt package was split across four deals, right? So you have one property. It was purchased by Rexford Industrial Realty last month for $182 million. It backed one $94 million loan, but that loan was cut across four CMBS deals. So you had four trustees, four servicers. There's a lot of moving pieces here. And that's not unusual in the CMBS world. However, something that we look for in the TREP bond modeling team and the TREP data integrity team is to make sure when loans pay off or when they default or when losses are recognized, that the numbers add up, that the losses are distributed across the different loan pieces properly and so forth. And what jumped out at us in this particular case was that the borrower, when this property was purchased, went to pay off the loan. And they had the ability to pay off the loan with a yield maintenance charge. And these yield maintenance charges can be sizable. And I'll let Lonnie and Joe get into this, what a yield maintenance charge is, in a second. Or unless you want to jump in now, Joe.
Yeah, so let me just jump in and just mention, like, you talk about the lumpiness and maybe repeating a couple of the things here that you said, Mattis, but in CMBS in particular, it's almost a requirement to have some restrictions or disincentives for borrowers to prepay, because the bondholders on the other side who are receiving the principal and interest payments, they're buying bonds with the expectation that those bonds are going to be outstanding for 6, 7, 8 years, right? Weighted average lives, durations of that, about that much. And if you have a bunch of the loans underlying the deal prepaying early, then you're going to end up paying too much for those bonds. So there's a lot of disincentive to prepay. And that disincentive is in defeasance, lockout, and then what Manus just mentioned, which is yield maintenance, which is if you do prepay, you have to kind of make the bondholders whole for all of the interest payments that you are not going to be paying over the next 3 or 4 years because you're prepaying.
Right. So in short, if you were going to prepay from a 6% or refinance from a 6% loan into a 3% loan, you would save an awful lot of money. This yield maintenance offsets that savings and serves as a disincentive to prepay the loan, kind of what Joe just said. So in this particular case, the yield maintenance on this $94 million loan was $20 million. So more than 20% of the loan balance was going to have to be paid back. And they could do this because the property appreciated by more than 50% in recent years, and there's enormous amounts of excess profit. So they can pay a $20 million yield maintenance charge, the borrower can, kind of painlessly.
And can we call this, Mattis, can we call this a green shoot?
Well, right? It is a green shoot for sure.
For this particular owner, it's a heck of a green shoot. When I can eat a $20 million fee, essentially, because the property has appreciated so much that it's worthwhile for me to just pay that fee and take the rest of the appreciation, that's a really good green shoot. And we saw a lot of this in, I'd say, maybe like 14, 15, 16, when a lot of borrowers who had refinanced or gotten financing in like 11 and 12, you know, at probably like not great terms, right? Not great levels of proceeds. By 14, 15, 16, their values had appreciated so much off of the lows of the GFC that they would pay huge defeasance costs or huge prepayment penalties just to lock in all of that appreciation. So this is a green shoot for, you know, property values, not necessarily a green shoot for the misallocation of funds, which I'll let you finish.
Just to take it from the top, $94 million loan, four pieces, four CMBS deals, $20 million in yield maintenance to be distributed. This yield maintenance should have been distributed pro rata between all four deals. One of the deals had a $40 million loan slice. One had a $35 million loan slice, a 22 and a 13, right? So four different loan slices should have been distributed parts of that $20 million yield maintenance. As it turned out, all $20 million was distributed to one deal. So three bondholders or three tranches in one deal collected $20 million when they should have gotten $8 million. Nine tranches in three other CMBS deals got bupkis, nothing, zero, shut out, right? So this is what we call in our business leakage, right? It's kind of like losing inventory in retail, right? To damage or other things, right? This is very hard to notice. It's easily missed, easily dismissed, right? Yet, when you look at in public records, there were 37 separate entities including some of the biggest names in the financial markets, that we're going to lose in aggregate $12 million of payments. So that's really the headline of this. And so there's a couple of parts to this. One is, you know, we're giving ourselves a shameless attaboy right now because some of our analysts found this and were able to go back to the trustees in these deals and say, you've made a huge error here. You've shorted these people $12 million and you've got to clean this up. And that's in the process of happening, right? That's part of it. But the other part of it is that these things are complicated enough that if you don't have somebody, you know, overlooking this stuff for you, like a really dedicated analyst, a surveillance person, or somebody like, you know, our TREP team, to give us one more attaboy, right? There's this opportunity for leakage. So this is a trading alert that we sent around on Wednesday night. Got a lot of traction. We had a lot of our clients coming back to us, you know, asking us which bonds were impacted, how much money we were talking about, and so forth. If you think that you might be impacted, feel free to reach out to us. We'll tell you which bonds were shorted. Happy to do that. But it just shows that some of this lumpiness can really add to complication that you don't see in the residential space and in corporate bond space, right? It was an interesting twist and something, frankly, I was quite proud of our finance team for catching this stuff. It's not easily detected.
Yeah, so I'll just point out that this is a big story for the niche of CMBS that we live in. And for those outside, this is not something that happens very often, right? The trustees and servicers are extremely good at their job. And this is a complicated situation that this is an error that we've probably seen similar errors of this magnitude a couple of times over 20 years, right? But this is the type of thing you do have to catch, right? It reminds me of that old story, Manus, of when you guys built benchmarks because you had a client come in screaming at you. Right. So because of all of the lessons learned in the early days of CMBS, there are a lot of processes in place, at least here at TREP, that can catch these things.
Yes, I would add that some of my best friends are servicers and trustees, and I hold them in the highest regard. I think they do. And things like this happen, and we do work together with them and them with us to make sure that we get this stuff right. So definitely not using this as an opportunity to besmirch anybody.
No besmudgery here.
No, absolutely not.
Turning to office, a couple of positive stories, a report from CBRE of market activity in major U.S. cities found that the sublease availability index fell in August. Those sizable backlogs of space remain. Boston and Atlanta registering the strongest comebacks. So that was an upside story in office. And we also saw the story of Google planning to buy a Manhattan office, and not a small one, but one for $2.1 billion, a sign of its commitment to New York and the office space.
And I just want to say that Martha and I happen to be in the office. So like, just saying, if Martha and I are in the office, like, what the heck are you people doing? Get back to the office already. And I can also, that means I hear her in stereo through the headphones and through the walls.
I think you need to add in the office work expert to your resume there, Joe, because you've been preaching that for about the last, I think, 12 months. so it's good to see that you're persevering through the stereo echo in your headphones. I would say to this, Martha, it's interesting. You know, the report from CBRE talks about, you know, the lack or drawdown in the sublease space. Does it say if that sublease space was actually taken down at the sublease rental rate, or is it because the folks offering that space were actually coming back into the office? Because I think, you know, you could read this as a positive sign if the current tenants were reoccupying the space and there was no rental loss. If this is something where they're having to sublease the space at something less, I think we're going to talk a little bit later here about, you know, some of the shockwaves that could come through the office market here in the coming months when that sublease rental rate becomes the new market rental rate. And I think as it pertains to Google, you know, this is an interesting perspective of, do they just have so much cash on hand that they have to find a place to put it? And they're looking in the long game thinking, you know, maybe $2.1 billion for an office building in Manhattan long-term is going to seem like a really great deal, even if they don't have any intended use for it, you know, right now.
So Lonnie, we were talking a little bit about the different versions of rent, and we figured, because this is episode 101, of the Trepwire podcast, who better to have on than our resident professor of real estate, Lonnie Hendry to give us a little 101. But before you do, I just, maybe before getting into the rent stuff, give us your forward-looking hypothesis on the office market in general. I know that you mentioned a few things in our prep call that I may or may not agree with, but I want to hear the pros' opinion here.
So I think office is something that has some headwinds facing it here in the near future. And I think they could last longer than what many experts are predicting. And I say that for a couple of reasons. If you look at the impact to hotels and retail, you know, non-grocery anchored retail at the onset of the pandemic, they were impacted immediately. But if you look at the office REITs, they're reporting rent collections over the pandemic at around 93 to 95%. They haven't really felt the impacts. I think where we're going to start to see some headwinds is as these sublease market rents start taking effect and in-place leases start to roll, there's going to be a hard reset of what the current market participants are willing to pay for the same space. So not only are they potentially going to downsize their square footage, but they're also going to want to pay significantly less for that same square footage. So, you know, you talk about maybe some ripple effects from a refinancing perspective. If you're in a multi-tenant office building and your market rent drops, you know, 25% to keep the occupancy up, the lender is not going to look favorably on that. The value is going to come down from an appraisal perspective. The amount of proceeds, if any, that you can take out are going to be diminished. So I think for some of these one-off corporate campus type of users, maybe they see this as a really great buying opportunity and maybe there's some opportunity for them to secure a low basis. But if you're a multi-tenant office operator, I think the next 3 to 5 years are going to be really tough for you as the rollover starts to occur.
And I know I've said this many times, but I'll say it again. It's kind of, I don't know, is it like, isn't it ironic or Alanis Morissette style that all of the companies that are fostering a world where working from home is possible are the ones that are taking up all the office space, right? Microsoft, Google, I mean, I don't know about Zoom, but you know, all of these tech firms that are enabling people to do everything from their couch and their phone are also the ones taking up all of the office space. I just find it interesting.
Well, I think they maybe view real estate from a different perspective of just as a percentage of their overall portfolio and a hedge against what maybe is to come. I mean, I don't know if we're not sitting here in a few years talking about these office spaces having been converted to something completely different and maybe something that's way more technologically advanced. I think, you know, what's interesting is I was looking at as some of the research that I was reading, getting ready for this. If you start looking at healthy building scores and some of the tech required for the ventilation systems and all of this stuff in these office buildings to be competitive in today's market, you know, maybe it makes sense for some of these tech-driven companies to be the owner operator of these buildings because they probably have some creative minds that work there that can create some really intuitive systems that are native to the buildings. So that might be something that we see a little paradigm shift in just how these firms operate the real estate relative to the historical norm.
All I know is that JLo is a brand ambassador for that healthy building company. So if she's interested in coming to score our office, I mean, I'm all okay with that.
One of the things, and I know this was in the journal article about this story, was the topic of recruiting people and how challenging it is to recruit people. And so New York is attractive because Google now has probably around 12,000 employees in the New York City area, and it's a good place to try to find talent compared to smaller cities.
Yeah. I think that goes to just like how they're viewing their, it's like a holistic approach to their operations. And so as the competition for talent, you know, continues to increase, you're going to see people looking at cities and places that provide them the highest quality of life, you know, on a relative basis. And if Google can have a really great workspace that maybe isn't utilized today, but gives them a competitive advantage into the future when maybe things return back to normal. I think they're willing to absorb those costs and they have the capital to do that right now versus maybe some traditional operators that might not.
It doesn't hurt that Google is one of the few companies in the world that could pay for a $2.1 billion building with petty cash, right? The office manager can dip into petty cash and next thing you know, you have an 800,000 square foot building.
That little pouch with the zipper on top. Like, here you go.
The kitty.
Oh, no, the one you take to the bank, that one.
Yep.
All right. So we're going to go into some Professor Hendry rental rate definitions, because I think it's helpful for many of our listeners to hear some of these definitions that are concerned about this.
So a great segue with the heated office debate between myself and Joe, but I would say tagging on to the episode 101, again, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I do think real estate is an interesting concept. So we have a lot of jargon and a lot of nomenclature in the CRE landscape. And unless you're, you know, privy to the local market practices, something as simple as rent can become somewhat confusing. So not to be too definitional, but at the same time, to give you some context, you know, I've identified four types of rent that the market generally recognizes. The first is market rent, which is typically, you know, presumed as the most probable rental rate that a property should bring in an open and competitive market. You have effective rent, which is effectively rental rate net of financial concessions. So if there's any rent abatements or periods of free rent, if there's any above or below market tenant improvements, they need to be netted out or added to the market rent. Then you have the actual rent, which is sometimes referred to as the street rent, which is effectively the rate that's charged to residents or tenants that occupy the lease space. And then you have a face rent, which is the quoted base rental rate before considering any rent increases or incentives. This is, you know, used interchangeably with asking rent or face rate. So I think where it becomes very interesting, we've hit on a couple of these tenants in the previous discussion, is, you know, with the sublease rental market, you kind of have a bifurcated marketplace right now where you have contract rent, which is effectively what people are paying per their contract today, but may not be reflective of market rent in the open and exposed environment. So if market rent is significantly less due to the availability of sublease space and those leases rolled and you reset the new market to that lower rental rate, I think that's compounded in the current environment because we're very supply constrained given the impacts to the supply chain. So if you have a large tenant leave an office building and you have to re-tenant that space right now, your tenant improvement costs are going to be astronomical relative to historical norms if you can find labor to even perform them. So from an operator or a landlord position, not only are you going to face the immediate impact of a decrease in rent, but you're also going to have the headache of trying to locate supplies and people to do the work that you're going to have to factor into your, you know, rental decision. On top of that, the last 5 or 6 years, the landlords have had all the leverage in the negotiation. So they've been able to be pretty bullish on what their renewal rates are, what the terms are, et cetera. And it's done a complete 180 now to where it's in the tenant's favor. So I think a lot of these things are going to be very interesting to see how they flesh out. But in the interim, it may cause some confusion amongst the participants because you may have a very clear bifurcated rental rate market. The way tenant improvements and leasing commissions are handled are going to be significantly different because the landlords no longer have the power to dictate the terms on that. So you may see deal by deal specific concessions or underwriting. And so just as a participant in the market, I would say, make sure that you're talking apples to apples when you're looking at contracts or you're looking at due diligence if you're looking to acquire an asset, and make sure you fully understand what the term means in practice.
Lonnie, let me ask you this, that, you know, if you're a tenant looking for space, what is the impact of how deep pocketed your landlord is, right? A guy with deep pockets, low leverage, lots of cash can wait out a market, right? Can wait out backfilling a tenant. Whereas somebody who, you know, has less room to maneuver, right, might be more flexible to give a more favorable deal to the prospective tenant. You know, what is your thought process there?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think it kind of depends on the maturity of the tenant and what they're looking for. So if you're an established company in an established market, you may not want to go with the lowest cost provider that can get you the best deal, because if that landlord goes into bankruptcy or the building goes into default, that can cause negative impacts to your business on the whole. At the same time, though, you don't want to overpay just because of, you know, the owner's maybe brand recognition or operating experience in a particular market, if you can get a competitive deal that offers you the similar, you know, utility for a lesser cost. So I think, you know, we're in a period in the market where having professional representation that are very familiar with what the norms are in a particular marketplace probably pays dividends for the tenants at this point, because they're not used to navigating these markets when there's so much turmoil and upheaval. And so I think today, you know, having representation as a tenant is very impactful, because they can probably help save you headaches and or real cash.
Having heard that incredibly lucid explanation, I'm now going long Lonnie.
I was
short Joe, long Lonnie.
I was thinking, like, we should have gotten a Tenant rep as a sponsor on this podcast. This would have been a perfect episode to have Tenant reps and sell our first real advertising on the podcast. Email us at podcast@trep.com if you want to advertise. And if you want Lonnie, the rates are double.
So I know we have a must know, and it is in the Office Space.
Yeah, this is kind of a modest one for people who have listened a long time.
You know, should know. It's a should know.
It's a should know, not a must. It's something we try to inform our people to make sure that they don't miss big stories that are out there that potentially could lead to new tenants in their buildings or new opportunities. This one comes from The Real Deal. They were reporting this week that Fortune 500 company Fiserv, which is based in Wisconsin, has agreed to open an office in New Jersey in the town of Berkeley Heights. They are expected to bring 3,000 new jobs to New Jersey. As part of this, they were awarded an incentive by the New Jersey Economic Development Authority to make this move. There's a very good chance that they already know where they're going to move to in Berkeley Heights. It just hasn't been revealed yet, but you never know for sure. And that's why this is a should know and not a must know, that if you have a space in the Berkeley Heights, New Jersey area that needs filling, now would be the time to drop that LinkedIn message or phone call to the executives at Fiserv. Maybe there's a deal to be done there.
You know, I live 2 minutes from Berkeley Heights, right?
Are you looking for a bigger domain than what you currently have? Are you looking for an office that can house a family of four and 3,000 workers?
You know what? There's only a couple places that can house that many people in Berkeley Heights. Exactly where they are.
Coach, maybe you can go tie up the deal. Get a little get a little fee on this.
I think I'm going to have to do it. I'll walk around, show some offices, you know.
If nothing else, we'll make you the representative of TREP that goes out to the location and does the live report, like the weather people that do the hurricanes and tornadoes and floods.
I think that was the first time I've ever called you coach live on the podcast.
Live. So
it's a little inside baseball for all you people out there. Martha is not Martha. She's coach.
Only to some people. All right. So we have a couple programming notes. I'm going to take a second and mention that TREP is going to be at the Global ABS in London. So if you're going to be there September 27th and 28th, look us up. And if you're not going to be there, give us a shout and we will send you whatever stuff we give away there, whether it's a research report or a magazine, which I think they're going to be distributing there. We'd be happy to share that with you. And the other note is that TREP is again accepting nominations for future CRE Leaders Awards. If you know a senior who's graduating college this December in finance or real estate, and you think they'd be a good candidate, send us a shout and they could be featured in our magazine with CRE Direct. So it's good press for people looking for jobs.
So it just made me think, you know, I teach, I know Lonnie teaches too in college, and the kids are so much better than I was. Like, when I was in college, and I don't know if I just wasn't paying attention, which may have been the case. Like, I may have just been thinking about other things, but I feel like now, like, kids are so much more advanced in terms of getting internships and networking and being on LinkedIn and doing all this. It's just kind of wild to me. And I just wonder, was I just like totally not paying attention at all? Or are they just way better at explaining how these kids should be doing things in school these days? So that's a rhetorical question I just wanted to throw out there. But
I think on my scale, you're a model student, because I remember periodically having to be kind of nudged by, you know, the janitor. Class had ended and my head was still back on the, you know, the back of the, you know, the chair, sound asleep, classroom empty, the lights being ready to be turned off. And
come on, man. You were the guy, like, Goodwill Hunting. You were like solving the equation on the chalkboard, no, like in your sleep while you were like sleepwalking.
Yeah. Correcting the teacher in the other room. Let me show you how to do that equation.
Yeah. So I can actually jump in there. I was out in Lubbock last week at Texas Tech at an alumni event for the real estate center. And to Joe's point, just crazy impressive how these, you know, recent undergraduates are getting themselves in the field and actually doing deals, and folks that I maybe taught 2 or 3 years ago that are, you know, coming back to these events and sharing with us how they've you know, helped underwrite or acquire several, you know, multifamily projects or brokered hotel deals. And it's, you know, they're 24 years old and, you know, rocking the Rolex already. So, you know, maybe times have changed a little bit. I don't think I took that path. I needed to get on the express lane and I was still over there yielding to traffic, but it's incredible to see the students leverage technology. I think that's one thing, like the social media, getting themselves out there, announcing internships, like they're getting ready to sign, you know, for a professional sports team. But it's really interesting to see how they're leveraging all of that into really great jumpstarts into their career.
Should we make like a TikTok version of our products or something? Maybe that
would appeal to that group, wouldn't it?
By the time we finish building it, it'll be on to the next thing.
The TikTok, we'll have Manus do a dance and.
Actually, that would go viral.
That would be viral, actually.
That would totally go viral.
That'd be viral. All right. So shout outs. I am going to give a shout out to Paul Z, who admitted to having listened to our podcast. So hopefully he'll listen again soon. Graham O gave it. We got tons of congrats on the 100th episode, which for people who weren't part of the recording, we were off the rails, just so people know. It was probably the craziest recording, and thankfully Haley whittled it down to its most salient content.
Thank God for Haley. It was the worst episode we've released. So thank you for those who actually listened to it.
So we got a ton of those. Joseph F, Mark T, he said, loves it because it directly correlates with his CRE loan risk discovery and mitigation work. Mike K liked the White Plains Mall asset story. By the way, a lot of people liked that and commented on that. Black Eagle Real Estate and Deborah M. Manis, you'll love this. She said she used to work at a Sears portrait studio.
That was one sad place, you know, dressed up in polyester.
Lots of very itchy turtlenecks.
Itchy turtlenecks, you know, uncomfortable polyester, sweating terribly, you know. At that age, you don't have a fashion sense, but when you look at the pictures afterwards, it's just mortifying. And it just seemed like an endless line, right? It was just, you know, among the most scarring, you know, 4 hours you could spend in your childhood.
Daniel B. on Twitter, congrats on the 100th episode, PB Dogged. Loved the story about White Plains. Yanni M., he actually told people, you got to give it a listen. They just hit the 100. Congrats to the team. Scott B., who's a friend of a friend, he reminded people that there was a giveaway at the end of the pod. And I got to say, not too many people
got it.
So, so we're going to keep our AirPods because no one guessed the names at the end. You know, Manus, I know you're a fan of Las Vegas. I don't know if you saw the story of the moon-shaped resort that's been designed. It's basically a massive moon ball that'll be on a platform. It'll make you feel like you've gone to the moon for the night.
It's like Epcot.
It kind of looks like that. It's that kind of look. I don't know how it's going to work inside. I did see that on CNBC this morning. Yeah, we're going to talk about Vegas for just a minute. Normally, this is the part of our podcast. We do a little slice of life stuff, but I'm going to try to tie this back into real estate. We had been postulating for a long time that office returns and office travel, business travel would be slow to recover. Leisure travel would lead the way. But it was really a thesis. You know, I hadn't been to New Orleans or Orlando or any of these other destinations since COVID began. So I was kind of talking a little bit off the cuff, but I did go to Las Vegas last week, and I'll break the code. I will not be bound to, you know, what happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. I'll try to share what I saw. And the short answer is that we've used the term before that this, you know, nightly Mardi Gras that everybody's anticipating in March and April, night after night of New Year's Eve nationwide, as we came out of COVID, was going to be the new norm, right? That never really took place. It's taking place in Las Vegas, right? I went out there expecting to see 60 and 70 and 80% occupancies, you know, mostly full casino tables and so forth. Nothing could be further from the truth. Rooms, you know, hotels, 100% occupied, flights out there, 100% occupied. I think they had an iHeart radio concert that had more than 100,000 people attend. Half the state of Iowa was in Las Vegas because the Iowa State football team was there to play UNLV, and Iowa State's pretty good this year. Incredibly long lines for coffee and sold out shows. Like, you know, I've been somewhat bearish on the strength of the recovery. If you were at it Las Vegas or you go out there, you will think that this is the roaring 20s. Everything is back. The one takeaway I had, or two takeaways I had, one was it was great to catch up with a couple of listeners out there who coincidentally were not from Las Vegas, but were there at the same time, a couple from Dallas, which was nice. But the other was, I thought it was kind of humorous. The first couple of nights I went to bed with my hands tucked behind the back of my head, like I usually do, looking at the ceiling. And the only thing I could think about is this gosh darn vaccine better work, because I came into contact with about 10,000 people today.
So I want to say a couple of things. So I was out with a listener last week. I actually mentioned it on the pod, and he actually said, did Manis end up going to that Death Cab for Cutie concert? So I was like, wow, you get extra credit for actually listening to all those nitty gritty details, which I'm sure you didn't. I got a picture from Manis from his trip, and you know, it's him and some buddies, and I was very happy for him. But at the same time, I sat there kind of sad, because I said, this guy's got more friends than I do by like a mile. Like, it's like 10 guys who go out to Vegas every year. Like, I don't think I could scrounge up two. So I guess, you know, everyone likes Manis a lot more. And I learn that every day with the podcast replies.
I'll throw one more thing out there, just in response to what Martha said before. Want a big thank you to Yanni for not only listening, but also promoting us to his fellow followers. That's really nice of you to do that. We're really grateful for anybody and everybody who supports the podcast here. We consider you part of an extended family for the podcast. So thank you again.
And with that, we'll close. Thanks to our producer, Haley Keene. Thank you, Lonnie, for joining us this week. Join us next week as we review what's happened during the week and how it may be impacting you. If you have a question, a comment, send an email to podcast@trep.com. For more information, visit trep.com and subscribe to the podcast with your favorite provider. Thank you for listening, and stay well.
All right.